Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. Originally, I wanted to make this episode about all the weird deaths and explosions and the helicopter crashes and all that whatnot about Ukrainian officials. But, when I was digging that one up and understanding who also listens to my show, I understood that I'll wait a bit, a week or so maybe. There is some stuff that I know that is a bit time-sensitive and, well, I have some journalist integrity and I don't want to hurt my Ukrainian allies here. But there's plenty of other stuff to talk about. First of all, Arestovich said some interesting and harmful things in one of his reports, and then, he resigned from his position, which I still don't know exactly what was his position. He was an advisor to President Zelensky, I suppose, but that was all a bit weird. And it's also super weird that he's being super defended by a lot of Russian liberal opposition people. Even though, he's not the super Saiyan saint that everyone portrays him as. But interestingly enough is that I wanted to know the Ukrainian opinion on this, and it's not as easy and, simple as you might think. Even taking into account the fact that I have not been using Arestovich as a source except one time in the early war because his reports, they were less useful to me than you might expect because he likes to exaggerate things a lot, and that's just from my position. But when I asked about this on Twitter, I won't mention the names of people here because, I don't know, they didn't give me their permission, but to quote comments from a person who's a Ukrainian about Arestovich, that there were claims that, quote, he was mostly working on his personal brand in recent months and had little to no value policy-wise. And that, quote, Arestovich really is a grifter and a megalomaniac. He almost never admits his mistakes. Also, carrying on, he's also a jack-of-all-trades, master of none. A psychologist, a military expert, a TV ads actor. He's a shady dude with no clear expertise and too much self-confidence. He had a high point at the beginning of the invasion because a lot of people felt his reports were reassuring and calming. After that, he has said a lot of weird and toxic stuff that really harmed the trust he gained in the first weeks of the invasion. Finally, he spent way too much giving hours-long daily interviews to Fagin, which is a Russian blogger, journalist, who now lives in Ukraine and, whom I watch sometimes and War Translated does his reports all the time, but I don't find Arestovich that trustworthy, But carrying on from my Ukrainian guy, it felt like he wasn't really doing anything other than media appearances, boosting his personal brand and spreading weird ideas. And, carrying on, Arestovich has said many weird bullshit about women, Ukrainian journalists and anti-corruption activists. Finally, in times when Ukrainians are finally getting free of pan-Russian worldview, he says he's a deeply Soviet person, pushing some weird revisionist version of history. Now, I couldn't find evidence on the revisionist version of history, but this reminded me that people in Ukraine, whom I met last time I was there, also stated that Arestovich is a problematic figure, to say the least. He's apparently very anti-feminist, and, but not anti-feminist in the sense that there are anti-feminist people in the West. I do have to give this explainer here. It's just that, in the Soviet era, those kind of people, they don't understand really what feminism is, and there's still these interesting views about women here. And just because Soviet Union did actually have a lot of gender equality, in some areas at least, in others it was a bit different, of course, but it's a complex matter. At any rate, if I just say that he's said things about women, it doesn't mean that he's the same way as the anti-feminist people in the West, just letting you know that. But there was a lot of things said about him, and one of them was that he's also quite homophobic. That's the deeply Soviet people part. That's the Soviet mentality that I try to rid of. I just wanted to mention on this show that, although a lot of people claim that this is a weird tragedy and that people are, they shouldn't be arguing amongst themselves, and they really shouldn't, really. There is much more to Arestovich than you might think, and the fact that he has his own, brand and such. That is true. Now, I wish only the best for him, because obviously he's done a lot of good as well. But, and the fact that he resigned instantly after his mistake, which is a completely enforced one, he could have just kept his mouth shut, but he didn't at that point. at least that proves that, you know, despite his faults, and my Ukrainian audience definitely knows that he has many of them, I still consider him to be quite an honorable person, at least from what I've seen, and I'm pretty sure that a lot of people in the West also will find it the same way. That's the first topic of today, because I need to make this episode somewhat short, because I have a lot of things to do, and I have two recordings tomorrow. One is with Leith from Social Streamers, who does EU4 streaming, and we're going to talk about racism in games, and other part is also about quite racism and all that stuff, and like I mentioned last time, it's going to be with the Secret Police podcast and with History Impossible. It's also coming, so busy day tomorrow and a lot of things to prepare. But I just noticed weird advertisements coming from Russia these days. Lately, you know, since technically the first wave of mobilization hasn't even ended, since Putin didn't ever sign a paper saying it does, and his words said on television mean nothing, yeah, they've started to roll more ads, which have caused a bunch of uproar and shock. See, in Russia, they're now running a bunch of ads aimed at people in the regions outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg. And these ads are all about why you should volunteer to join the army and stuff and join this war. But the problem is that they're played in a way that's kind of offensive and, well, is causing a lot of issues to the thinking part of Russia, to the opposition part. Because these ads are people stating that their salary is low, that they're totally in debt, and that everything's miserable, and that they have to work two jobs to make a living, and they're tired of all this nonsense, so they're just going to go and volunteer. That's one ad. In the other ad, the grandpa is selling off his old car just to make ends meet because his pension is low and he's been scammed off of something, and then his son just comes in and basically says, "Daddy, you don't have to sell your car because I've signed up and I'll go fight in Ukraine and stuff." They're playing up all the realities of life, which are in Russia outside of Moscow, basically literally portraying all the negatives and all the impoverished, corruption-filled, insanity-filled, crime-ridden stuff that is well, quite unthinkable to the Western world, and just saying that, hey, you can get this influx of cash if you go in Ukraine, it's going to be great, because they play up this whole part. At the same time, Russia is airing ads in the Western world advertising how they're a better place to migrate to move to. They're running ads advertising their vodka, their great education system, and all the health, and all the industry, and cheap energy, and it's kind of weird how you're portraying life in Russia as, at the same time, better for people who come to your country, who'll probably get mobilized anyways, because everyone doesn't like you, and also how you're running like sort of a weird ad underscoring all the terrible realities in the life of rural Russia, all the while asking people to come and join the army. I find this a bit mesmerizing, to be honest. But to talking about nonsense here, yeah, I posted this on Twitter a bit ago, like yesterday, I think. But in this misunderstanding of reality, another weird thing that happened is that one of the YouTube channels that I watch daily, basically, which is full of Russian propaganda and all this stuff. This is what General Kvachkov, Girkin's buddy, goes on to speak about how evil we are here in the West. Girkin's been quoted there often. All of Girkin's friends go to that channel, okay? So, and they posted on thumbnail section another kind of info about their upcoming video, which is about to air soon, so I'll watch it. And the video was how Russia should act as the evil empire everyone else thinks it is. And they invited some, you know, Mikhail Kalashnikov, that Girkin's buddy who runs Roy TV channel, who's a futurologist by his own claims, and has anime girls and his, like, wallpaper there in his blog, but whatever. But, yeah, to illustrate this, and I laughed out loud, and by the way, interestingly enough, my editor from Foreign Policy magazine even retweeted this, because it was just so silly. Basically, they looked up something that would be, they just Googled evil empire. I'm pretty sure they did, because they have no idea what they just did. I'm pretty sure that's a massive fail. So what happens if you Google up evil empire in Russian, apparently, is that Warhammer 40k stuff pops up. Yes, and not even the video game stuff. No, no, no. They managed to put in an Imperial Guard Lemon Russ battle tank with some guardsmen, but like the box image. You know, To those of you who know Warhammer 40K, you must be giggling right now. I know that. To those of you who have no idea what Warhammer 40K is, that's a tabletop strategy war game, one of the oldest in the world, published and created by British company Games Workshop. And it happens in the very super edgy, grimdark 41st millennium, and there's this massive Imperium of Man, which is basically a gothic Catholic church in space mixed with a bit of fascism thrown in it. It's weird, okay? Everything is so dark to the point of being hilarious, okay? The good guy faction, sort of, who claim to be the good guys, and the sort of good guy, the Tau, they ran concentration camps and forced sterilization. The setting is ultra dark, okay? And it's a tabletop game where you glue miniatures together and paint them and play games with them. You know, strategy stuff. And these guys on the propaganda channel just typed in Evil Empire, and it got them to the Imperium of Man, Imperial Guard, or as they say now, Astra Militarum, which I totally disagree with, but whatever. The box set. So now Warhammer 40K, a British tabletop game, has been used for propaganda reasons, which I also found hilarious. And finally, there's an article about the war, thanks to War Translated. These guys are great, because they do translating stuff, where Igor Girkin, our buddy here, gave commentary to Russian SV Press, a publication, on the timelines of the further progress of the Russian forces in Donbass. And here's a translation of this thing. SV Press. Even in the summer, analysts voiced that Russia will take several months to liberate the front lines of Seversk's Soledar Bakhmut. And now these months have passed, and the enemy's line of defense is gradually shifting to the west. Sooner or later, the armed forces of Ukraine will roll back to the next line. Sovlyansk, Kramatorsk, Druzhovka, Konstantinovka. How do we break it? Do we continue going straight ahead or around? Maybe to the south, or maybe better to the north? What kind of scenarios can be there? The question of what will happen next is better to identify in advance, as it would be nice to find an answer to it in advance. The space in front of the line of cities from Slovyansk in the north to Konstantinovka in the south can be occupied. All the way to Bakhmut, there are only fields and small villages. American military experts even say, quote, the left bank of Dnieper is a desert. That is, the Russians can get through this territory relatively easily. But how to take one fortified area that is essentially elongated from north to south? Here, one city passes into another. Apparently, we will again have to gnaw through step by step, freeing the west of Donbas. It would be necessary to act more cunningly, to maneuver, but is it possible? To answer this question, and I quote from the article here, we turn to the ex-minister of defense of the Donetsk People's Republic. Ah, that's a nice way how to lick Girkin's butt, but whatever. The head of the social movement Novorossiya, Igor Strelkov, I will still call him Girkin. Not a chance I'll ever call him Strelkov. Who believes that it is premature to talk about reaching the line between Slovyansk and Kramatorsk? That is, however, very true. Quote. And then he responds. So far, there is no discussion even about the capture of Bakhmut, because the battles for this city continue. And it has been under siege for a long time. Therefore, to say that we will soon go to Slovyansk can only be corrected relatively soon. In general, my position on the operation which is being carried out by the Russian military command in the Donbas is quite well known and is defined by the words, it is yet to be done. All over the world, it has long been customary to bypass defense nodes, to force the enemy to leave them without a fight. And we decided to act according to the patterns of the First World War, and in its worst versions. I'm sorry, like I said, have to rush this one a bit. It's hard for me to say when our troops will reach the line Slovyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka. Maybe relatively soon, maybe not very soon. Maybe in the coming months they won't reach it at all. There's a fairly large foreground there, and the quote-unquote respectable Ukrainian partners will not leave without a fight. But in any case, even if we reach this line, it'll be a pity if these cities are also destroyed during offensive operations, as Bakhmut has now been destroyed. And it will be even more difficult to take them because they are much larger, much more strongly fortified. If in Soledar before the start of the special operation, the population was just over 10,000 people, then Kramatorsk until 2014 was a city of 150,000 people. No Wagner group is enough to take the agglomeration by storm. This will require way more forces. Frankly, I do not share the victorious and, as they say, ultra-patriotic moods of our media after the capture of Soledar. After all, this victory means practically nothing compared to, just for example, the surrender of Kherson. And even the surrender of the much larger city of Izium, which happened during the so-called regrouping, but in fact it was a retreat of our troops from the Kharkiv region. SV Pressa continues. But after all, the armed forces of Ukraine also suffer, in your words, ultra-casualties. But the leadership in Kyiv planned this. They're preparing reserves in the rear, but do not bring them into battle. This happened near Popasna, which is in Luhansk, near Severodonetsk, near Lysychansk. And later, they threw these forces into a counterattack on Kherson. Are we seeing the same picture now? And Girkin responds. The enemy still retain their reserves. Moreover, they create new ones. They do not bring them into battle, do not expose to our blows the most combat-ready units intended for offensive operations on their side. Instead of them, the territorial defense is firing, various reserve units formed from mobilized. And they hold back the staff units, as they did last summer when our troops stormed positions in Severodonetsk, Lysychansk, and Denpisky. Whether the enemy is going to strike or whether he keeps these units in reserve to repel our offensive, I do not have this information, since the only source of information about the enemy's forces for me is the internet. And this source is very incomplete and unreliable. Hey, Girkin, you should have listened to the Eastern Border. I mean, I'm pretty sure he never will, because he doesn't understand English, so that's a bit of a saving grace here. But carrying on. But I look at which parts of them are involved in Soledar and in Bakhmut, and state the fact that there are no shock units and formations of the armed forces of Ukraine at the forefront. SV Press, and this is the final one. This is not a very long article. What would you advise our chief commanders to do? Or is it not worth doing this at all, keeping a military secret? And Girkin responds in his awesome fashion, which is why I like to include as much of him in this show as humanly possible, because we see his doomer Girkin voice just going downhill as this war progresses on, which is interesting. I don't know. As I'm going to write a book after this war about all of this, there's going to be a special Girkin check in every chapter, because he's gone down, he's been to the front, he's lost his head, he's done all sorts of crazy shenanigans. You gotta love this man for just being so bizarre in all of his weird villainy. But I sidetracked once again, just to finish this one. Our command does not need advice. It does not listen to them, and often acts illogically and completely opposite to what is required. They did not carry out an offensive operation on Dnipro to cut through enemy's communications between the Dnieper and Donbas. They won't do it now. And in Mariupol, the enemy left the garrison just enough to divert our forces to it. Now it has become more difficult for us. Everywhere, from the Kinburn spit in the south between the Dnieper and the Black Sea to the border with Belarus in the north, the enemy has formed a continuous line of defense. I don't know what our military leaders will do, and it's useless to advise them anything. According to the ex-minister of defense of the Donetsk People's Republic, now SV Press continues, now one can see a kind of repetition of the same picture that emerged in the spring and summer when the armed forces of Ukraine in the Donbas deliberately fought to deplete the potential of Russian troops in those fortified positions. Yet, the armed forces of Ukraine fail, retreat, lose ground after fierce heavy fighting, but their failures are tactical. But they do not touch their strategic reserves. Perhaps they are preparing to repel our future offensive in other more promising areas. Or maybe they are planning on victory somewhere. They, that is the Ukrainians, are surrendering their positions on the fortified Soledar-Bakhmut line, not trying to make serious breakthroughs. They do not send their main forces there, if, of course, the Bandera regime still has them. But according to Girkin, Strelkov, whatever, the management of the battle by our Western opponents remains clear and thoughtful, although very bloody. Now, to comment on this, because I can't just give you this article without comments, it's not one of those wicked events one. The fact is that Russians are very aware of what's going to happen in April, because, as far as I know, 500 specialists are being trained by the United States right now. And there's promise of tanks, promise of everything happening. And, to quote one of my favorite video games of all time, overconfidence is a slow and insidious killer. So, not to be overconfident in all of the situation is one of the smartest things Ukrainians can do. But right now, well, as we can see here, the Russian side is the one which is filled with dread and uncertainty. They are looking at the Ukrainians to do something, and I'm pretty sure Ukrainians will attack only when it's totally guaranteed that they will break through. And to that, they're looking up for, you know, Western heavy weaponry and their own training. And that's why it's a bit of a shame that we still have to punch Schultz to actually send those Leopard tanks. And punched he should be, because, well, like I said, there are no two Russias. The one Russia that's fighting in Ukraine is the Russia that is threatening everyone else, and who's going to attack Germany? Like, how? It's so weird. I mean, if you defeat Russia now, then there will be no Russia to threaten you in the future, so this is for all of us in a way. But yeah, that's it for today. Like I said, bit short, but still pretty intense and lots of work because, again, two interviews tomorrow. And I have an Estonian listener who's coming to visit in the morning. So I hope he's coming in the morning because I don't know how I'll manage everything. You know, the one day that you plan, it's going to be weird. But yeah, well, let's end with the usual stuff then, I suppose. If you want to support the show, please consider becoming a Patreon on patreon.com/theeasternborder. And if you want to give us a one-time donation, which I'll be frank with you, I really want to... A guy on Facebook is selling off the whole complete Soviet sci-fi collection translated in Latvian. That was a series in the world of sci-fi, and it has Asimov's iRobot and everything. It's 51 books, and half of the money is going to Ukraine, and... For my sci-fi fan inside me, having all the classics was just awesome, but it's €250, and I just moved. Painful. That's going to go into some, you know, library for the sci-fi and fantasy society if I get this ever, because that was a bit crazy. But also preparing for Ukraine, so if you want to support our show with a one-time donation, then please go to theeasternborder.lv and click the donate button there. And I'm speaking kind of fast now because I have to rush, but yeah, and even if you don't support the show, it's just really important that you listen, actually, and, you know, to keep you informed. I don't like to do these segments about, you know, how to support the show and whatever, but truth to be told, you guys are literally paying my salary. I don't have another day job because I wouldn't be able to run the show as I do because this is a full-time job. It takes about, 8 hours per day, bit of a minimum since I do a translating stuff and I do communications and I have to basically dig through all this nonsense. So thank you guys because you are all of you comrades. You're my boss. Don't have another one. That's about it. But yeah, до свидания, товарищ. And as always, remember that happiness is mandatory. And massive thank you to all of you guys who support me, because once again, deeply thankful for everything.